And of course, it is Groundhog Day, February 2nd. It is also Thursday afternoon at 5:30, and that means we are joined by Scott Washington, Hillsborough Town historian, for another round of History Matters. Hello, how are you?
Well, I'm doing good, Aaron, and happy Groundhog Day to you.
Happy Groundhog Day to you. What is your Groundhog Day tradition? How do you celebrate this great family holiday?
Well, I'll tell you, we do it in a very personal way because my daughter, my oldest kid, was born on Groundhog's Day.
Really?
Yes,
oh, it actually is a family holiday for you.
And luckily, she did not see her shadow and, decide to stay another 6 weeks, so...
That's good. So, February 2nd is Groundhog Day.
Yes.
Why is it Groundhog Day? There was a great history.
Right.
Like, we're always talking about this week in history.
Yes.
So, this day in history is the celebration of this totally random, weird, bizarre, cockamamie, out-of-nowhere holiday that means nothing. And
yes.
How does this weird tradition come to be? But there's actually a couple of cool stories behind
it. There are. And it goes back. Actually, you can go as far back in recorded history. People have always been prognosticating about how long will winter last.
Yes.
And February 2nd happens to fall about 40 days after December 25th, which is Christmas. So it seemed a natural time in the year when people started looking forward to spring.
Mm.
And this was a great way to celebrate. And so, in Roman times, we see processions of lanterns, people celebrating the light and coming back because the days are starting to get a little bit longer. And then in early Christianity, you have Candlemas, celebrating Jesus being brought to the temple. Well, this got
which is February 2nd.
That's right.
Yep.
But still, yeah. The lore of exactly how long is winter going to be, what's it going to be, has led to things people looking at, the caterpillars, they're long, or, gee, the bears are hibernating,
yes.
or acorns. In fact, I have a good friend in Mebane who said, there are so many acorns, I'm sure winter will be long.
Sounds like Mebane.
Not quite yet, but still, it's exciting to see, and that's why we have this tradition that started in 1787. 1887.
1787, people were focused on something else.
But Clymer Fries, editor of a local newspaper, a Punxsutawney Spirit, began promoting the town's groundhog as the official Groundhog Day meteorologist. And then it's picked up from there. Now, I should mention that in here's the Carolina connection. Aaron, you'll like this. There is a Sir Walter Wally.
There is indeed.
That's right, who prognosticates. And today, I guess, and I was waiting anxiously, as we all were, and he did not see his shadow because it was overcast.
Okay.
So the forecast is in early spring.
Early spring, because Punxsutawney Phil said the opposite, right.
And that may be true for Philadelphia.
Yes,
Punxsutawney
is probably going to get snow again a few more times between now. Yeah. That's the other thing. Like, one of the stats here, Wally has been right 58% of the time. Phil has been right 37% of the time. How do you measure correctness here?
Well,
it's an interesting question.
This is a really good question North Carolina State University actually started looking at the average for every day and saying, was it above the average or below?
Okay.
And they could actually start to say how close the percentage was in terms of prediction. It's great to see scientists
scientists and groundhogs working together to predict the weather for all
this
of us.
This is what education is all about.
From here on out. So there's Walter Wally in Raleigh. There's Grady the groundhog at Chimney Rock. There's Punxsutawney Phil up in Punxsutawney. There's, what else do we got? We've got Mojave Max, T-Boy. Pierre Shadow. I get it. And Claude the Cajun Crawfish, who gets the drop on everyone with the prediction on February 1st.
And my daughter is in Louisiana, and she would say, yes, they listen to this. And I said, there's not a lot of snow. I'm sorry, in New Orleans.
In Shreveport, of all things, like, you got to do something in Shreveport on February 1st. It's not that great of a town day.
I'm delighted that it falls on today, so we could celebrate a good day.
All right. So this week in history, what else happened this week in history?
Well, it's interesting. January 31st marks the date in 1865 when the House of Representatives passed the 13th Amendment. That had already passed the Senate in the spring. It goes out to the states for ratification. There were 36 states, and they needed 27. North Carolina logged in at the 26th state, and when Georgia became the 27th state to ratify the amendment, it becomes the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and part of the United States Constitution, outlawing slavery.
Yep, and on December 18th, it became part of the Constitution. So it's a year and a half process between the Senate, or more than a year and a half, actually almost 2 years between the Senate in the spring of 1864, I guess.
Right.
And then it takes another 9 months or so for the House to act,
yes.
And then it's another, basically, an entire year of individual
That's
states
right.
ratifying, during which time the Civil War ends,
right.
Southern states start getting included back into
That's
the
right.
Union, and one of the conditions of them being included back into the
yes.
Union was ratify the 13th Amendment,
That's
right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I believe so. Yep. So that really is an important date. It's followed by another one that happened yesterday, February 1st,
yeah.
1960, when the four students sat in at the
Greensboro lunch counter.
Yep. Uh-huh.
The Woolworth lunch counter 57 years ago.
Oh, isn't that astonishing?
I have no idea how the time has gone.
And all they did was they sat down, they refused
yep.
service, and they stayed until it closed. They came back, it was nonviolent, they were inspired by Martin Luther King, but this movement grew.
Yeah.
As word got out, 70,000 people participated in sit-outs all across the Southeast, became one of the largest. Not the first, but certainly one of the largest.
And it was exponential. There was February 1st,
gosh, yeah.
four people sit in at the lunch counter. The following day, 20 people show up. The following day, 60 people show up. The fourth day, 300 people took part. Now it's
right.
spreading to other communities across the South, and eventually it spreads really across the
That's
country,
right.
and 70,000 people take part in this. It's a story about the ability of just a couple of people to make a
yes.
difference, but it's all about organization. It's
That's
all
right.
about getting people together in a
about
common
people
cause.
Power. Yeah,
it's about
we've
people
seen that
power.
In the last 2 weeks. Even.
Yep, absolutely.
And the International Civil Rights Museum there in Greensboro is where you can go actually see the counter or a portion of that counter,
mm-hmm.
and it's a great testimony to the power of people to change the times.
Yeah.
What I love about that end of that story after they were there for 5 months and three weeks and three days, that the manager just quietly takes the three African-American employees
mm-hmm.
and after work sits them down at the counter and serves them a
yep.
meal. And
now desegregation
That's
has happened.
Right.
July 25th, 1960 was the desegregation of the Woolworth
yes.
lunch counter in Greensboro. So this is the better part of half a year.
Yeah.
Almost half a year it takes for Woolworth to desegregate. So it's organization, it's people power, and it's persistence.
Yes. Yeah.
Like if you lose the first weekend, come back for a second weekend and a third and a fourth, because you might not win right away,
right.
but that 30th weekend
right.
things are going to happen.
That's
yep.
right. Yeah.
Yep.
And that's how change occurs, which
yep.
is, that's what makes history exciting. When
yeah.
you see it happening.
Yeah,
like this.
Exactly. So speaking with Scott Washington, Hillsborough Town historian, we've got This Week in History, and there's so much going on over the course of many, many years. And I know there's one that you're excited to talk about, which is February 4th. So
yes.
this Saturday is the anniversary of something that we've actually talked about in
right.
the past, which is the first Electoral College
that's
vote.
That's right.
The
yes.
Electoral College.
Well, and maybe you can talk about the
yes.
Electoral
yeah.
Oh, it's shocking almost.
Yes, yes.
You know, the idea that George Washington gets 100% of the electoral
100%
votes.
100% of the votes.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
On two occasions. But can you maybe explain why this was a controversy and what led to another constitutional amendment about this?
In 1789 and 1792. Well, in 1789 and 1792, you've got the Electoral College. It's established, but there's not really a whole lot of procedure. The Constitution is very vaguely written. It's big,
right.
broad brushstrokes. You know, we talk about, and we're having this debate at the Supreme Court with Neil Gorsuch,
right.
who
yeah.
is an originalist. Go back to the original intent of the framers. How did they want things to be interpreted? The original intent of the framers was for future generations to fill in the blanks
yeah.
as they saw fit. The original intent was for there not to be an original intent. Anyway, so I'm getting off track. But because of that, the Constitution is written in big, broad brushstrokes. So when it's talked about the Electoral College, it sets out the basic parameters and the basic framework, but it doesn't really specify how exactly.
No. And it didn't say about president or vice president.
Or vice president, right? So the initial Electoral College in 1789, they go on February 4th, 1789, Electoral College vote, and all of the electors are chosen by the states through their own various mechanisms. States get to determine. States still to this day get to decide how the electors are to be chosen. They go and they vote for two candidates, and whoever gets the most votes is elected president, and everyone votes for George Washington. And then you've got this second vote, and whoever gets the second most votes is vice president. So you just George Washington and somebody else.
Somebody there he was running against becomes his vice president.
Yeah. And it ends up being John Adams. And then it really becomes an issue in 1796 when now you have parties, you have campaigns, you have candidacies. Right. You don't have a George Washington who everyone is just unanimously agreed on. And now you've got John Adams winning and Thomas Jefferson getting the second most votes. Because they still haven't figured out the concept of a running mate. So now party number one gets to be president, party number two gets to be vice president. And then in 1800, they figure out the concept of a running mate, but they haven't figured out the concept of, these two votes are for the same thing. So Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr are running together on the same ticket.
Now, were they in a musical at that point or not?
Not yet. Yeah. Leslie Odom hadn't been born yet. But now they're running together on the same ticket. So all of the Democrats go and vote for Jefferson and Burr. Right. But there's no distinction between president and vice president. So Jefferson gets X number of votes. Burr gets X number of votes. And now it's a tie for president and who's the president and who's the vice president. It's supposed to be Jefferson as president and Burr as vice president, but Burr sees an opportunity and starts campaigning, and it's nuts.
Yeah.
Until the 12th Amendment, Jefferson did become the president because of Alexander Hamilton, who hated Jefferson with the burning passion of 1,000 suns, but hated Burr with the burning passion of 1,001.
And isn't that great?
Yes.
That's the way politics.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about all this is that George Washington, there is an actual connection, a Carolina connection. I don't think a lot of people know this, but there is a house that George Washington stayed at over in Hillsborough. Now, George Washington never visited the Carolinas, but in 1791, he made a 1,700-mile trip through the South, which he had never visited before.
Yep.
And among the stops, he stops at one fellow's house, a Dudley Gatewood. And we know it because there's journals that were kept. And Washington, renowned for his honesty, is scrupulous about saying when he left, where he arrived. And on this particular occasion, he's at this house. Well, historians never could figure this out. But James Freeland, the Walt Disney of Hillsborough, the fellow responsible for the Daniel Boone Village, was a great history enthusiast, kid at heart, and he heard about this Gatewood house up near Danville that was the last tenants had moved out in 1978, had no running water or heat, electricity, and he got permission to move the whole thing lock, stock, and barrel to Hillsborough. And that's where it is today. Now, you're probably saying, where is this place? It's now known as Pueblo Viejo.
Yep.
It's a Mexican restaurant. But if you go in there, the ceilings are tall. And the Gatewood family, which had eight kids from 3 to 18 there, it must have been a lively thing. But that particular day, when Washington's there, he actually leaves late, about 6 a.m. Now, I say late because usually he was off at 3:30 in the morning most times. And so it's
like
said, what is going on? Well, it turns out
I want to know what's going on with him leaving at 3:30 in the morning. Do you get up and leave in the dead of night?
And
like,
why of all these?
I am not paying for this. I'm just getting out with my horses before anyone else is awake.
They thought maybe he had a good breakfast, but it turns out that there may have been another connection because earlier in 1781, when General Cornwallis, the British general, was pursuing the American army across North Carolina, Nathaniel Greene's American army, right in the middle of winter in February, they have to figure out something because Cornwallis is right on his tail. And they come up with a plan. And either Dudley Gatewood was in on the planning or the execution or both. and they devise a diversionary army of about 800 men. Carts, horses make a lot of noise, and they head straight up towards Danville. And Cornwallis falls for it. He chases the wrong army. The main army, Nathanael Greene, who did not want to fight these battle-hardened troops, they go up into Virginia, and they're safe. But Cornwallis is chasing the wrong army. He's thinking, great, I'll get up to Dan River, and I'll smash him. And the Dan River up there is like the Potomac. Except what Cornwallis did not know is that Dudley Gatewood was married to the niece of Walter Dix, the only fellow that operated the only ferry across that river. Cornwallis was determined. He said, I'll smash this resistance.
Yes.
And he burns his own baggage trains. He gets up to that river, and there's no
cross.
Army. In fact, it's on the other side. No way to get across. And knowing Americans' penchant for crude humor and rude gestures,
like we
I'm
do.
Sure both were hurled with great invective.
I have no doubt.
And the look on these people's faces must have been priceless. And Cornwallis has no choice but to slink back to Hillsborough, where he stays. It's not a good stay. He ends up fighting the refreshed troops of Nathanael Greene on March 15, 1781. Yes. Gets pretty much defeated, ends up going to Yorktown, where he is besieged by the French, and of course Washington helps in the war. So here, 10 years later, Washington is making this trip, and he stops at this fellow's house, and I can't help but think, we don't have the definitive proof, but you know, all the signs
they had to
of
have
pointed
shared
lines,
some old war stories.
That's right.
They
would have had such fun.
Well, I got to tell you, this is the second time this week I've heard this story, because we haven't aired this on the air yet, but coming up in a couple of weeks, Warren Bingham is going to be the special guest speaker at the Chapel Hill Public Library's Meet the Author Tea.
Yeah.
And we had him on, like he was swinging through this week, so we had him on to sort of pre-record an interview, and he wrote a book called George Washington's 1971 Southern Tour, which talks about that exact moment in history. And we talked about Pueblo Viejo and that you can go to Hillsborough and eat Mexican at the house where George Washington stayed. And Scott's laughing right now because I've got the visual aid. The book is in my hands right now.
I had a descendant, a Dudley Gatewood descendant, Ann Evans, out in California, in her 80s, and she called me up very excited. She's a great genealogist. She said, oh, I found a connection. She said she was doing genealogy and found that there was a descendant of Dudley Gatewood that was in the Mexican-American War, and there was also a descendant of the Freeland family in that same war.
Nice.
And here it is, this is almost like the Disney movie Holes, where they end up, you know, a century later, moving the house down here and saves it for future generations.
That's great.
And, of course, March 2nd, actually. I mean, I'm sorry, March. It's February 2nd. Is when the Mexican-American War ended. So
there you go.
interesting week. This is what makes history so fun and exciting.
All right. Well, that is History Matters for this week.
Yay.
Happy Groundhog Day, Scott Washington.
All right.
I'll talk to you again soon.
We'll see you next week.
All right.
And remember, keep an eye out because history is happening all the time.